This episode is brought to you in collaboration with XOX Handmade Gifts, inspiring radical self-love and radical kindness with every bit of stationery and handmade gifts. That's XOX Handmade Gifts. Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Welcome back, everyone. I am Renee Powers, and I am the founder of Feminist Book Club. I cannot wait to share today's episode with you, but before we get into it, I have to take a moment to talk about what's to come for the holiday season. Obviously, Feminist Book Club believes that feminist books and woman-owned businesses should be on everyone's holiday wish list. So, we are putting together some really, really incredible holiday bundles. We will have bundles starting at $25, going up to $100, and you will find a gift for every budget with free shipping in the United States. Our gift bundles will include a book written by a previous podcast guest, including today's guest, plus gorgeous products from woman and queer-owned businesses, something for everyone. We've got candles, we've got mugs, journals, socks, hand warmers, tea, nail polish, totes, you name it, we've got it in a bundle. So, for example, I'm going to give you a sneak preview of a couple here. Not sure what to get your aunt that you only see a couple times a year? How about the historical fiction bundle? It's got The Stationery Shop by Marjan Kamali, plus a tote bag, a peppermint candle, luxurious body butter. I'm obsessed with this body butter, by the way. A journal, an ear warmer, and gourmet chocolates. Now, how about you're looking for something for your late teenage stepsister? The YA fantasy bundle might be just right for her. It has Lobisona by Romina Garber, a necklace, a candle, a fun tassel keychain, and a trendy bag. These bundles aren't on our website yet, but I wanted to put the bug in your ear so you can plan your holiday shopping accordingly. We're working hard to get everything together so we can add them to our shop as soon as possible. Make sure you are on our mailing list and are following Feminist Book Club on Instagram to be the first to know when those bundles go live. They are in demand and we have limited quantities, so make sure you're keeping an eye on everything. Links are in the show notes. Okay, next bit of business. Our December theme for our book club is Afrofuturism. I'm so excited about this. Members are currently voting on titles to decide what will be in our box. Some of the top contenders include The City We Became by N.K. Jemisin, Kindred by Octavia Butler, and the Binti Trilogy by Nnedi Okorafor. We will announce the book of the month next week. They are currently voting, and there won't be a recount. All of the products in our December boxes will be from Black woman-owned businesses, like the one we're featuring today. So here you go. The first product reveal for our December box is handmade journals from Minnesota-based XOX Handmade Gifts. Founder Caesarea is deeply dedicated to inspiring radical self-love and radical kindness through her Etsy shop, XOX Handmade Gifts. XOX only sells eco-friendly and sustainable stationery and gifts because she believes our homes deserve some love too. If you're in the market for a new planner especially, I recommend The Radical Agenda, which, love the name, it is an undated bullet-style journal that helps you track your schedule and your self-care. You can find The Radical Agenda at XOX Handmade on Instagram, which is xox.handmade.gifts, or search XOX Handmade on Etsy. I've got links to those in the show notes. All right, now it is time for our interview. Today's guest is Hallie Sutton, who I must apologize to because I mispronounced her name in the reading wrap-up episode. It's Hallie, not Haley. I should know better. Her debut book, The Lady Upstairs, is a topsy-turvy twist on the noir genre. We talk about what makes it noir, power versus equity, the Me Too movement, and why we love a good con artist story. I don't know about you, but I am a sucker for a good con. And be sure to listen to the end for lots of excellent book recommendations. Enjoy.
Hi, everyone. Today, I'm so excited to be talking with Hallie Sutton. Hallie is a writer and editor who lives in Los Angeles. She's a Pitch Wars mentor and holds a bachelor's degree in creative writing from the University of California, Santa Cruz, and a master's degree in writing from Otis College of Art and Design. Her writing has appeared in Crime Reads, Monday Night Magazine, and more. And today we're talking about her debut novel, The Lady Upstairs. Welcome, Hallie.
Thank you so much for having me. It is so exciting to be here.
I am so excited to have you and talk about this book. But we do ask the same question of all of our guests, and that is, what does it mean to you to be feminist?
What it means to me to be feminist is to advance the goals of equity and parity for all people, regardless of biological sex, gender identity, gender presentation, however you identify. Our goal should be dismantling systemic barriers and raising the standards of living for everyone.
I mean, how hard is that?
I know. Why is that hard to get people on board with?
Seriously.
Yeah. What's good for, you know, one person is good for everybody. So it's enjoying the same rights, responsibilities, and freedoms, in my opinion.
Amen. Amen. So how does that influence your writing? That definition of wanting, you know, the most marginalized to have the same as the most privileged. How does that influence your writing?
Great question. I would say it influences my writing. I'm always interested more, whether I'm reading or writing, in the story of the underdog, in the story of the person who doesn't have necessarily the most opportunities. And, you know, there's varying levels of that, obviously. I tend to write from a female perspective, but there's, even within the female perspective, there's a lot more, you know, experiences than just one plain experience. But when I was writing my debut novel, The Lady Upstairs, which is a feminist noir novel about women who run a black male agency in Los Angeles targeting bad men like Harvey Weinstein bad. It was very much on my mind was what are ways to achieve power, maybe, which is not, in my opinion, the same as equity or parity. And I wouldn't necessarily say that the way that my characters go about obtaining power is a feminist ideal that I would encourage for anyone. But what I was trying to kind of get at in the novel with that is this idea of what do you do when you don't have power? What are you willing to do to achieve it?
Oh, that's so interesting. Reflecting on that, I can see how that is the thread that runs kind of the undercurrent of your book, The Lady Upstairs. And I love what you said about power does not equal equity. It is not the same thing. Having power is not the same thing as having equity. Can you talk a little bit more about or untangle that a little bit more? Give some examples, maybe?
Sure. So having this conversation less than a month out from the election, it is hard not to be thinking about whose voices end up mattering more in the election. I don't think there's an argument that could be made that we have achieved gender equity in this country. And yet at the same time, some women have more power than other women. And some women use that power to vote, say in 2016 for President Trump, 52% of white women. And I don't know the statistic exactly off the top of my head, but I think it was 94% of black women voted for Hillary Clinton. And it's an interesting thing to look at where power is kind of centered and how that can be used to advance equity.
I gave an interview recently and they asked me something about basically, like, why do you think there are black women in the Trump administration? Mm. And I mean, I can't speak for black women.
Right. Me neither. Absolutely.
And, you know, and people of color are not a monolith.
Right.
What I can say as a woman, as, you know, someone who does have at least one marginalized identity, is that sometimes being close to power feels like mm-hmm. equity, even though it's not. And
right.
we will throw other people who have the same life experiences as us under the bus in order to achieve a little bit more power.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yes, that makes me think of the ways you're absolutely that, like, sometimes women are more likely to align with men in power versus other women, as opposed to being like, you know, if we grouped our power all together as women across color barriers, we could achieve more than but it is easier in some ways to align yourself with the people in power, and that it feels like equity, feels like, I mean, but with the Amy Comey Barrett hearings right now, and like how that aligns with a certain type of power, but is not necessarily about equity or parity or advancing either of those.
Yeah. Well, okay. So, I mean, this is a conversation that I think our listeners are having over and over again with their feminist friends as well. And I know definitely that I could dive in for the full hour and talk about these things, but I do want to talk about the lady upstairs. If you're feeling like you need a good distraction that also feels like revenge in a good way, that this is the book for you. So you gave a quick overview, but can you dive in a little bit more and tell our audience about this book?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. I love the way that you described that. And it comes out November 17th. So we might need it more than ever. We'll find out. So The Lady Upstairs is a feminist modern noir thriller about a woman. Our main character is named Jo, and she works with her best friend Lou and her sometimes paramour, Robert Jackal, as this kind of blackmail outlet in Los Angeles targeting bad, wealthy men. And they basically find and hire women and train them to seduce these men and either acquire power via that blackmail seduction, acquire money, which sometimes are equated to the same thing, or kind of have this to use in their back pocket. And so Joe's latest case is with a young woman named Ellen, who is seducing basically a Harvey Weinstein stand-in, a guy who's kind of a notorious casting couch king. And it's been this Hollywood rumor forever, but they're kind of trying to use it to their advantage, let's say. And things start to go a little wrong with the case. It's not closing as quickly as Jo would like. And she is trying to pay off a debt to her boss, who is a shadowy figure named the Lady Upstairs, that they call the Lady Upstairs. And so when things start to go wrong with the case, Jo starts to get a little desperate and starts to get a little sloppy and make a few mistakes that might have deadly consequences.
Gripping. Okay, so I read this book and it's described as noir, and I was like, yep, that's a noir. What does that mean though? What are the elements of noir and what makes this that genre?
So great question. I feel like noir is one of those things that's kind of like that great quote about pornography where it's like, you know it when you see it. It has kind of a certain feel, often if you're looking at kind of the sui generis of the genre back in like the 20s and 30s, it's kind of this like rat-a-tat dialogue, often centering a man who's a private investigator, who's, you know, seen too much, other side of the law, has got a dame who's, you know, calling to him, the femme fatale. And it's kind of about this disenchanted worldview. You know, historically, it came out of a disenchanted worldview post-World War I and World War II, just kind of idea that, like, the world is not right, the world is not what we thought it was anymore, which I feel like probably some people are feeling in 2020. I know I have been for a while. And there's certain tropes that go along with it. You know, there's the femme fatale, there's kind of the misdirection, the MacGuffin, the investigation. And so for me, what I really wanted to do with this book when I kind of figured out that it was going to be a noir throwback was I wanted to take the character, the femme fatale, which has historically been this projection of male insecurity and anxiety about the role of women. You know, post-World War II, more women are entering the workforce, and so they're kind of dangerous. Their sexuality is a little bit more dangerous because it's owned more by them. And so we get this character, this like archetype of the femme fatale, who's this woman who's basically her function is to bring danger to the male protagonist. And I was thinking post kind of the Me Too movement, and as I was trying to figure out what to do with the strong voice of this character, Jo, I had in my head, what if I made it a literal femme fatale? What if it wasn't just the idea of kind of the projection of anxieties about a woman out to ruin a man? Like, what if I made it absolutely, that's her actual job. If she had a business card, it would be like, I destroy men. That's my job.
And it's so satisfying.
It was fun to write.
I was going to ask you that. Is it as satisfying to write as it was to read?
It was very fun and satisfying to write. And I would say one of the critique that I got from my editor when I eventually sold the book was kind of, which I think she was absolutely right on, but it was kind of bringing forward more of Joe's motivations in doing this. And I remember having the thought, like, who wouldn't do this? And then I was like, I guess a lot of people, but like this, you know, why would Joe engage in this kind of blackmail business? And I think it was a really cathartic place to put a lot of ragey feelings about the inequity of the world and the, as a woman, just kind of the things you see regularly on a daily basis. So often you kind of get numb to them, but what if you could put it somewhere? And this is where I put it.
Do you think that you could have written this had the Me Too movement not kind of pulled the curtain back the way that it did?
Actually, yes, I do. So, I mean, the Me Too movement really starts in 2006, right, with Tarana Burke, but like it becomes more mainstream with Ronan Farrow and Harvey Weinstein. I just feel like it's important to acknowledge that because I know she was doing it first. So I started writing this before that kind of more mainstream movement of the Me Too movement. But I mean, that's kind of the horrifying part of all stuff about the Me Too movement was that like we all knew Harvey Weinstein was a creep. I didn't know who Harvey Weinstein was, but you've heard stories about the casting couch king for forever, right? You've heard stories about men who abuse their power in these gross ways. And there's been a certain amount of, you just have to live with it. That's what the business is like. You know, you get your ass squeezed in the office. Well, that's just whoever down the road, you know, it's like, the Me Too movement kind of put a stamp on something that we all knew, but it was just kind of it being like, hey, all of those things, no more of that. Let's not do that. Or let's try to find a way to do less of that, I guess. So in response to that, yeah, my book was kind of in motion before that was making the news, but I would say that that movement kind of helped clarify and sharpen maybe some of what I was already thinking about.
Because I don't often read thrillers and I don't often read noir. And so it is one of those like, but it's also like some of the favorite television that I like to watch, like Jessica Jones and Veronica Mars.
Oh, totally.
Like very up my alley.
Yes.
I want to know what drew you to it and why you think that this genre is the right one, the most relevant one to tell this story.
So what drew me to it? There's a couple of different parts to it. I kind of, for a long time, didn't think I was going to be a crime writer. I always knew I loved to write, but I was kind of imagining myself more in a space of magical realism like Angela Carter or Kelly Link or Helen Oyeyemi. And then I had this really strong voice of this character in my head who turned out to be Joe, and I kind of didn't know what to do with her. And I kept kind of trying to put her in different stories and it kind of wasn't working. And then I decided to move to Los Angeles for grad school. I got into Otis College of Art and Design and was like, let's go live in Los Angeles for 2 years. I've never imagined doing that. Why not? And when I moved here, it kind of clicked because Los Angeles has such a long and storied history of noir, both film and fiction. And I was like, oh, what if it's a noir and she's a femme fatale? And it was kind of this lens that I could both write the book through and also explore the city through. You know, Los Angeles is kind of a made-up city with kind of a made-up center. No one really city planned the city. And I think it lends itself to this idea of what is Los Angeles. And so for me, it was kind of this like fictionalized look through the Los Angeles of noir. Like what is noir Los Angeles look like? Because you're only getting samples of that kind of in a lot of the classic films. So that was kind of how it came together for me as a noir and for me as a crime writer. And then I was also kind of like, I thought back about it and I was like, yeah, I like Google serial killers to fall asleep to, like reading down Wikipedia holes. So like, I'm a crime writer. Like that's, I don't know what I was thinking, obviously. but as for why I think that that's a strong vehicle is that noir actually has a pretty entrenched history of social critique and crime fiction in general. You know, crime fiction can be very kind of like dad thrillery, kind of this like upholds this old order of white supremacy, but it can also, I think at its best, and there are a lot of people who are doing this, like Attica Locke is the first person who comes to mind, but there are a lot of people who are using it to kind of critique, Steph Chaw is another, critique the social order and like turn the lens back on why is our system broken in these ways, and tell those stories that way. And I think that that's what noir was really doing too, even from the beginning, even when it was mostly told from the white man's perspective, was this idea of like something in our world is broken and I can see it and I don't know how to put it back together, but we're trying to figure a way out of it. And so to me, I think noir is like a very classic vehicle for stories about that. And I think that's also why you see, you know, noir kind of evolves into like also domestic suspense and other types of thrillers. And I think that that's why you see so many strong women who are really leading the fields with those books these days.
Yeah, I have to shout out one of our blog contributors, Steph Autieri. She wrote this fantastic post about crime writing and true crime as a way to recenter victims' voices, survivors' voices. And I thought, I mean, first off, she's brilliant. Steph is amazing, but also like that post is amazing.
So I'm writing that down because I need to read that post. But funny story, Steph and I share an agent, actually. I'm so wowed by her all the time. I just think she is like, I'm on her Thunder Thighs newsletter and it just is so fantastic.
We're so lucky she writes for us.
Yeah, totally.
So I do want to switch gears a little bit to Jo, the character. And you've mentioned that she was the voice in your head. She's the narrator of The Lady Upstairs. She's not the perfect main character. It is told first person through her eyes. And I think some people might even call her an unlikable female character, which the audience knows I love unlikable female characters. Do you think that makes her more feminist? I mean, that's a question that I think that bubbles up is kind of the undercurrent here is like, when women are flawed, therefore they are more feminist, but does that necessarily mean that unlikable female characters are always feminist? Like, I just want to have this conversation. I think you're the right person to have totally. This conversation with.
I am so excited to be having this conversation because I have a lot of thoughts and I'm really curious about yours too, which I think that part of why that's an interesting question is that it's at least in the case of Jo and often in the case of unlikable female characters or female narrators, I do think it's feminist to be telling the story of somebody who doesn't neatly fit into the box of I'm ascribing to all of the things that make me likable, that make me consumable in this super heteronormative way, which isn't to say that you couldn't be feminist or have a feminist character who does subscribe to those things.
Sure. Yeah.
Jo's actions are not always super feminist. So I think that it is like a dichotomy there. You know, Jo is basically somewhat using other women to gain power for herself and the people that she cares about. But I do think that the more space we make for the more unlikable female characters, or well, actually, unlikable male characters have had plenty of space for plenty of years. But
exactly.
But for female characters, and for people who, you know, don't have to ascribe to a certain identity to be worthy of having their stories told. And I think the more that we do that across literature, like the richer our society will be, the richer our literature will be. I think that absolutely that is a feminist movement towards equity. Is you don't have to be a certain person to have a story worth reading.
Okay, that's the destination I've been trying to arrive at and I've never figured out the way to get there. And you just did it for me. So thank you for that.
Oh, thank you.
The thing about Jo though, is I found her difficult, flawed, but also like so easy to root for. Like I wanted to see her succeed, even if success meant that it was going to be terribly dark and possibly someone's going to end up dead or in jail or all of the above. Mm-hmm. There's still something about her and kind of her quest that makes her really relatable in some ways, but you just like, you want to see her succeed.
Thank you. That's so nice to hear. You know, that was kind of my hope too, is that I was trying to write somebody who felt alive, which also means that you're a very flawed person. You know, she drinks too much. She's pretty messy, like emotionally. She makes a lot of bad decisions, but that hopefully it's still somebody whose journey you're interested in going on.
Yeah, definitely. Why do you think we love a good con so much? I mean, because she's at her heart, a con artist.
I think we love the idea of, you know, a con artist is somebody who knows more than the other person. And I think we all, maybe none of us want to be conned, but I think all of us have a little fantasy about conning someone and kind of being able to have that one over and play that trick. And, you know, some of the best cons are really kind of benevolent or not that bad. You know, there's a scene in the book where Jo basically makes this guy think that she might go home with him. She and her friend might go home with him and then run up a tab on his bill. And like, you know, that's the kind of thing that I think would be not necessarily ethical, but a lot of fun. So I think that has a lot of appeal. for research for this book, for The Art of the Con, a friend and I basically snuck into Disneyland one evening back in the before days when you could go to Disneyland. So that was my fun little research, really want to do the work, and wasn't at all about the free rides.
Absolutely not. I'm so glad you were so dedicated to your craft.
Thank you. That is me.
There's a lot of queer themes in this book, and it's another thing that makes these characters so complicated and complex, and the relationships between and among them so complicated and complex. Can you talk a little bit about why, I don't know, they never come out to the audience that they're gay, queer, lesbian, bi, pan, any of these things. And so I feel like that must have been a deliberate choice. And can you talk a little bit about these more sapphic themes throughout?
Sure, absolutely. So it was a deliberate choice. I think own voices novels are really important right now. And I am not somebody who ascribes to any particular label. So I didn't want it to be like that was necessarily what the book was about. But it felt very true to me. I believe that sexuality is totally a spectrum. And I believe that it's a spectrum in like a lot of different ways. And that, you know, you could be attracted to a few people of the same sex and a bunch of people of the opposite sex or vice versa, you know, that it just throughout your life is probably this shifting panorama of who you are. Not for everybody, but for some people. And for Jo in particular, it felt very much like she was not somebody who would have labeled her sexuality. That for her, it was more about who she was trying not to fall in love with. And the person that she's trying not to fall in love with is her best friend, Lou. Not succeeding very well. Spoiler alert, but I think that's in there pretty early. And I think it's really about, I think so often when we fall in love or really like feel connected to a person, it's about the way that they make us feel as a version of ourselves. And Lou is the person who makes her feel like the strongest, sharpest version of herself. And that was something that was always in the novel very early. And I think also for what they do, that it was, you know, that these women are to some extent sex workers, that it was really important to me that their sexuality be very fluid, because to me, that just seemed realistic. Not that that's true of all sex workers. That's not what I'm trying to say, but that for these characters, it was more about following their bodies and less about I am this or I ascribe to this, yeah. If that makes sense.
Yeah. It's more about desire than any label.
Right. Right. Yeah.
I found that really refreshing.
Oh, thank you.
That it wasn't just like, this is a lesbian novel. It's just like, this is a novel about a bunch of characters and some of them want to sleep with another. And that's just like what they do.
Totally. Totally. Yeah.
But I do want to talk about the name choices, because I noticed that Jo and Lou are both masculine, traditionally masculine names, and they're
totally
women characters.
Right. Yes, absolutely. And part of that is kind of a little bit of a noir throwback, in that oftentimes, you know, that was kind of like the tough dame thing would be to have this kind of like gender neutral name, or gender, the name could go either way. You know, with Jo too, in particular, it's Jo is a name that she picks herself. There's one moment in the book when she first meets Lou, that's kind of a flashback where you realize that like, oh, actually Jo's not her name, but it's kind of an identity that she's ascribed to. And so I kind of wanted to have that be part of it, and part of it in that, you know, I don't know that I would classify either one of them as necessarily gender fluid. I think both in the way that they present themselves on the page, they tend to present more stereotypically feminine, Lou in particular, but that a big part of the book is about how you change the way you appear for other people. And so part of that with their names is kind of this like trying to step into this tougher, sharper role. And so for Jo in particular, that the identity of Jo is like almost an armor suit that she steps into. And so I wanted her to have kind of this like brassy name to go along with it.
Yeah. Yeah. I would be remiss not to ask you, we are recording October 13th.
Yes.
Your book comes out November 17th.
Yeah.
The year of 2020, of our Lord 2020. It comes out after an election, it comes out during a pandemic. What has that been like as a debut author this year?
It's been a little wild. You know, I keep making this joke, and I think my publicist would wish that I would stop making this joke, but I kind of have this feeling that like how I'm going to feel about my book coming out will have a lot to do with the election. Like, of course, I'm going to be beyond thrilled. It's a life dream. It's like the thing that I've wanted my whole life is to have my book out in the world. But how the election goes before it is going to have an impact on that day. So like, I will definitely be drinking, but will it be sad drinking or happy drinking or both? Like, what are we going to be doing? You know, 2020 has been just kind of a year that I know none of us expected. And they tell you that your debut year when you are publishing a book is a whirlwind, but I don't think they meant it like this usually. You know, in some ways, it has been different than I expected. In some ways, it has been kind of the same. And in some ways, it's maybe been, it's hard to say better because it's been such a terrible year for everyone. But like, there have been interesting opportunities that have come up. Like my debut week, I'll be doing events with a bunch of different bookstores across the country, which I probably would not have gotten to do if it wasn't on Zoom. So there's kind of ways to turn lemonade or lemons into lemons. Lemonade. You don't want to go the other way. But but yeah, it's been kind of a different year. My book was originally scheduled to come out in July, and then we ended up pushing it back for a variety of reasons. But part of the reason was kind of, you know, when the pandemic first hit in March, no one knew what to expect for books. So,
and they were tough to get printed too. That was
tough to get printed. Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly. I do remember that, you know, I had friends whose books came out in like May and they were saying it's not in bookstores. It's not in places. So, I feel very lucky that we had the runway to be able to push it back. But I also encourage, when possible, people to support debut authors, and not just me, but like, you know, it's a weird year for a lot of people with books coming out.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And that's something that we like to do here at Feminist Book Club is, mm-hmm. is spend a lot of our time uplifting debut authors, because especially this year, but always, because that first book can really kind of set the path for you. And
definitely,
I think you're going down a great one.
Oh, thank you so much. I so appreciate that.
So we are winding down, and we wind down with the same couple of questions. But before we get to it, is there anything we didn't get to that you would like to share or discuss?
Just that I think the work that you're doing is so valuable. You know, with the Feminist Book Club, I think that it's so amazing the way that you showcase books and then products from female and queer owned businesses. I think that's so amazing. And just that it's been such a joy to be here.
Oh, your check is in the mail. I'll pay you later for that testimonial.
Perfect.
Just kidding. That was so kind. Thank you. Okay. So our last couple of questions are, do you have a book that you would like to recommend to our audience that's not your own?
Is there a limit on how many books?
There's, the limit does not exist here.
Yes. Perfect. It's not October 3rd, but we're there. So I would say today is the, I know that this won't be airing today, but today, October 13th, is the book birthday for They Never Learn by Lane Fargo, which is about a female serial killer on a college campus who picks the worst man every year to murder on her college campus. And then it goes a little awry.
I have to do a quick plug. We did do a review and an interview with Lane about They Never Learn on our blog, and Lane has been on the podcast as well. So we'll link those things in the show notes. Continue.
Totally. And if you liked our conversation about unlikable female characters, Lane has a whole podcast about it. So like, she is absolutely the expert. That sounds like a backhanded compliment, but that wasn't what I meant.
She understands.
Yeah. So other recommendations, Miami Purity by Vicki Hendricks is a female-driven noir from the 90s, which is just like this wonderful high-octane thriller about a woman who's unapologetic about her sexuality, and it basically retells Double Indemnity from a female perspective, a woman's perspective, and it is fantastic. Memorial Drive by Natasha Trethewey, I just read a few weeks ago, and I think I cried through most of it.
I was going to say, how are you still whole at this point. It's breaking everybody in a good way.
Totally. It's just so good. It's so heartbreaking. And this is like a whole separate conversation, but like, I think as crime writers, it's really important to remember that, like, I'm writing about theoretical crimes, but like, people get murdered in real life. And like, that I think was such a beautiful, like, look at the devastation that actual crime like wreaks in somebody's life and the way that she's put her life together. And, you know, just as beautiful. So, and then two more. I'm so sorry. I know this is a lot, but I just,
nope.
The Roommate by Rosie Dannon is a rom-com that made me believe in sex again. And I read it at the beginning of quarantine, and I feel like it's my comfort read all through quarantine. It is wonderful. It's this woman who's a little bit kind of like, maybe a little uptight, but like in a really wonderful, you know, loving way, moves in with a very attractive male porn star, and they sparks fly. It's
fast. I love this premise.
It's so good. It's so good. And finally, I also wanted to plug The Return by Rachel Harrison, because we are spooky season two. And it's actually a book that's great year round, but it's a horror novel where this group of close-knit friends, one of them goes missing and comes back 2 years later, and she comes back a little bit wrong. And the girls go on a girls' weekend to this isolated inn where all of the rooms are these different creepy themes, and things predictably get a little wild. And it was so good. I think it was the first book I read at the beginning of COVID-19 when I was really struggling to like lose myself in something because there was so much anxiety in the world. And I just loved that book. So
I think I might purchase that like right after this. That sounds, for some reasons, like I want to read that right now. I'm in the mood for that. Excellent.
It's so good. And it's got this like really striking pink and black cover. And I know covers aren't the reasons why we purchase books, but aren't they a little bit? And like, it just looks phenomenal on a bookshelf too.
Also, so does yours. The
thank you.
Purple and yellow. I mean, obviously there are brand colors, but I am so drawn to this color scheme of your book.
Thank you. I was so over the moon when I found that, when I, my team sent me that cover. I was just like, yes, forever. I have a big blown up. It's like it's really too huge. It's like 3 feet tall, poster of it up in my house. Like I'm a gross 1970s film producer, you know, but like, I'm so proud of it.
As you should. And you should take all of your selfies in front of it.
Oh, good call. Yeah, I should.
Well, if you do that and post them online, where might we see them? Where's the best way to get in touch and keep up with you?
Perfect. You can find me on Twitter at Hallie_Sutton. You can find me on Instagram at HallieSutton25. And you can find me at my website, which is www.halliesutton.com. And I have a newsletter that goes out once a month where I kind of do a roundup of like favorite things I've read or watched or seen or different things I like to plug, not just about my book. I don't find it that interesting if it's just about my book. So it's usually about like my friend's books, if you want to join. And we're going to have exclusive stuff coming there, including maybe a coloring book page and maybe an exclusive cocktail recipe for the book and just different fun things.
Awesome. I've been very into coloring during quarantine.
Yes, same.
That has been my kind of like evening wind down, like TV show,
totally.
Food Network probably, and coloring books.
Can I make one more plug while we're on the subject of coloring? Hello Harlot is a female owned business here in Los Angeles, and she does adult coloring books that are based on like the Real Housewives franchise, Schitt's Creek. She has one coming out from Penguin Random House that's like 90s nostalgia. So it's like Lisa Frank and scrunchies and stuff. And she is fantastic. So Hello Harlot is like a very cool business to know.
We can't be friends because you will make me spend all of my money.
Or we could be very good friends.
Exactly. Well, Hallie, this has been so fun. Thank you so much. We will put links in the show notes to where to find you, to all of the books and businesses that you recommended, and as well as your wonderful debut, The Lady Upstairs. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. This is the highlight of my week. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time. A well-read woman is a danger.